Chuck, thank you so much for making time today. I really appreciate it. As we talk through on this this podcast, we like to talk through about stories of growth, right? And how people have grown both in their career and business and in life and whatnot. And one of the things that you've been able to do over the course of your career, since I've known you and even before then, is you've continued to progress. And now you're the global head of HR for Permapipe, a global company, and I think you just came back from overseas. So tell us a little bit about the role you're in now, if you don't mind, and then let's talk about how you got there.
Thank you. First of all, thank you for having me. It's great to reconnect with you and have this conversation. So I joined Permapipe in September of last year as their global head of HR. We operate in six different countries. We're about almost, we're approaching that $200 million in revenue. We operate in North America and the Middle East. As you highlighted, I just made my first trip over to the Middle East in January, which was a very great experience. Hit the UAE and Saudi Arabia, where we have facilities there. We're a global engineered pipe services company, so we don't make the pipe, but we make it better. A lot of our goods are applied to what we call DHC, which is distributive heating and cooling. So a lot around steam plants or physical plants in hospitals and universities, airports. We also do a lot of fuel transfer, especially when you have tank farms, you're moving fuel from a big tank farm down to the where the planes park at the in the parts of the runway and stuff. So, we do a lot of business in Canada where we're both oil and gas and also a lot of water. But with the extreme temperatures of Canada, you've got to have pipe that's well insulated. So a lot of our pipe is either specially coated or specially treated with polyurethane and is used in a variety of applications. So it's kind of fun because Permapipe, majority of their business is not oil and gas, which is, it's been a while since I've been in a company that's not majority oil and gas. We do oil and gas and we've done a lot of work in oil and gas, but most of our work is around the heating and cooling and infrastructure projects.
Wow, that's interesting. I wouldn't have guessed that. And then when you talk about, you've got locations around the globe, how do you manage, with people up in, Canada and then the Middle East and whatnot, how do you manage that on a day in and day out basis?
Well, you got to have a good team. That's one. I think two is making sure that we're clear on what our strategic priorities are. So, from the standpoint of, workforce planning, make sure we have enough, headcount to execute the job, make sure they're trained to do the things that they need to do. Meeting customer expectations. I have a good network of, I've got two strong regional HR directors that has teams below them that are typically at our local sites. And so we work very hard together to ensure that we're pulling all in the same direction, around people. And it's, org design, development, succession planning, talent identification, talent development, making sure we're engaging with our people, communications, and also that they understand the strategic direction of where the company's going. We just are starting our fiscal year in February. We're rolling out our, what our strat plan looks like for the next 3 years. We're aligning our goals to that strat plan and making sure that everybody's, as we like to say in the South, singing off the same songbook, So part of HR's role is to ensure that the people are engaged and moving along with the organization and driving to the results, that we want to achieve.
And I love the way you phrase that. And especially at the beginning, when you were talking about the business and you were able to talk about the business in detail in terms of both the product, the technology, what the company does, where it does it, and the customers that they serve. I think a lot of times, people earlier in their career think of HR as just being focused on, plugging the right people in or managing people issues behind the scenes. But I think, you know, what I've learned over the course of my career is HR is a critical strategic function that's got to understand the business and be a business partner, right? So, talk a little bit about that.
I think I've been fortunate. I've had some really good mentors in my career. And I remember specifically, I came to Houston in the mid-90s. Penzel brought me here. And a guy by the name of Chris Curio was the VP of HR for, I worked for Jiffy Lube's division. So I supported all the retail oil change outlets in the Midwest. So, but he was the first one that really said, hey, are you looking at the POS system every day? Are you seeing what our stores are doing? You know, our ticket, our average ticket price, you know, what drives our business? And so he was very good about helping me get a better understanding of the value HR adds and how it fits into the business. And that really changed my whole perspective about the role that I should play as an HR leader. And I've taken that forward. So everywhere I've gone, you know, I understand the business. I understand the P&L. I understand, you know, HR is a cost. And anything that we propose or want to do has to have a return. You know, there has to be a value that's added. So that's a big thing I preach with my folks is, okay, we're going to do this. What are we returning to the business? So whether it's recruiting initiatives or benefits changes or, you know, the STIP plan, a short-term incentive plan, you know, it's got to return a value to the business. If you don't understand how the business works, you can't be a valued partner as an HR leader.
Yeah, that's, I love the way you phrase that because it's a critical requirement. And there's a lot of times that I see people get wrapped around the axle on performing a function or a job and just looking at it with blinders on, right? And it's recognizing that you've got to really understand, you've got to be excellent and an expert in your function, but you've got to understand the impact to the business. And it's everyone's job to help improve and grow that business.
Yeah, absolutely. And it you have better conversations. You ask better questions. I think one of the traits that served me really well, Mike, is I'm curious. I'm very curious about people. I love understanding people's stories and background and how they got to where they are. But I'm also curious about how the business works and how we make decisions and, you know, why we hire certain people and, you know, why are we looking at these acquisitions and or whatever. So that if you have that curiosity, it can really serve you well. But the other piece of it, when you're talking about relationships, that curiosity helps you make connections, that you find commonalities with people. And that makes the relationship a lot more robust and valuable. I think, you know, I'll shout out to another mentor, a guy named Al Scruggs, I worked in the textile industry to start my career. And he saw something in me as a young recruiter and said, hey, you need to get out of corporate recruiting and get into the, you know, to the operations side, manufacturing side of the business, if you want to go anywhere. And the best piece of advice he ever gave me, he said, relationships are like bank accounts. You make deposits and you make withdrawals, but you never want to overdraw the account. And I have used that for a lot of years. I'm not going to say how many, but.
Yeah, no, I love that. It was funny. I heard somebody once say that, you know, trust comes in drips and leaves in buckets. And it's the same thing, right? You make deposits in, and if you've got to make a withdrawal on something, it typically is a big withdrawal that takes a lot of time to replace that.
Oh yeah, and you know, coming into this role, as you've gotten a flavor for, I've been very diligent about going out there, meeting people, building relationships, because I know at some point I'm gonna have to make some withdrawals on certain things. And it's a lot easier to talk to Awad in Saudi Arabia if he knows who I am, or at least has a basic understanding of, okay, he's a decent guy and he's interested in what I do. And That's the other thing about global travel, right? If you go different places, and I've been very lucky. I would have never imagined I've been to the places that I've been to. And we have so much in common, Mike. I mean, it's you know, my HR person in UAE has a family and kids, and he's trying to move things forward and do the best for himself and his family. And yeah, has some of the same struggles and challenges that I do, you know, raising my kids. So you look for those commonalities, you make these connections. It can be very powerful.
I love the way you phrase that. That's really well said. So as you're thinking about that and those commonalities, one of the things that I've seen is you've continued to progress throughout your career. You've always, you know, taken steps forward and advanced, whatnot. What brought you to Permapipe? What was it that you found was really intriguing, right? And then if you look back over the course of your career, was there one point where you're like, this made a career-changing impact on me?
Oh, boy. That's a great question. You know, Permapipe was an opportunity. I'd been in the services business. I was in the testing and inspection business, which actually I'd been in for 10 years earlier in my career. And you talk about connections. One of my former bosses became CEO at Cayman and reached out to me and said, hey, I need a new head of HR. And actually had done that twice. First time I couldn't do it, and second time I did it. So the power of connections. And so I wanted to get back into manufacturing. So Permapipe, you know, we don't make the pipe, but we do have manufacturing processes. So it's good to get back in that. I wanted, obviously international global company, but also publicly traded. You know, I haven't been in a true publicly traded company since I worked at TechnipFMC. NexTier was publicly traded, but it was majority owned private equity. So the dynamics are different a little bit. And also it was 30 minutes from my house, Mike. So, I mean, it all those things kind of came. It was a perfect storm of the right things coming together. One of the board members is a former colleague of ours. So when you got these connections and know that these are people that you can trust, and then also just my conversations with the CEO, I just really felt like we could partner well together. And so far that's been really true. So I really like the CEO I'm working for. I like the executive team. CFO and I are really clicking together. And so when you have those type of executive team that's got those kind of relationships, it's very similar to what we talked about at Dresser, right? I mean, that was still probably the best management team I ever worked with was at Dresser. FMC was number two, but this is certainly, you know, starting that climb to match or exceed, you know, those teams.
Really? That, because you're right. And when we think back on our career, that the way that leadership team was put together, the alignment, the clarity of focus, right? And I mean, it wasn't without problems. It definitely had challenges, but there was just genuine alignment on that team. And like, we knew why we were coming to work. We knew what we were trying to do. And if there was conflict, it was conflict over the right way to do something. It wasn't conflict over, you know, who gets what office, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So those are the things you take with you, right? And so when you can find those again, as you talked about, you know, my career path has been really interesting because, like it or not, I've been involved in a lot of mergers and acquisitions. So, you know, if Dresser was still Dresser today, I'd probably still be there. But it got bought by GE. And so we got sucked into that, you know, vortex and I spent 3 years figuring that thing out. And I learned a lot. It was a great experience, but I was ready to eject. And Mark Scott was at FMC, and he said, "Hey, I want you to come over and you know, take over this, our biggest business unit from an HR perspective." And, you know, and so it was a great experience. And, you know, I hit the peak of the, when the industry was hitting the peak in 2014. And then, you know, I rode the wave down in 2016, 2017. So, but again, great experience, went through a big merger with the French company Technique, which learning experience, took on a big new role, had some unique experiences, and then it was the right time to do something else. So it's either figuring out, you know, taking advantage of opportunities is one. Two is making sure you have a good network and people that you know, because a lot of my jobs have come from referrals or, hey, we want you to come back or come work for me, or, you know, so I've been very fortunate. I've been very lucky, and I'm very grateful for that. So
yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So I guess it's, you think about that, and you know, most of these opportunities, if I had to distill down based off of what I heard from you, is you got some critical advice that really sunk home in the sense of it's a bank account, and then you've been making deposits in that ever since, and then that's been paying off and these other opportunities that have come out.
Yep. I mean, that's David Brown said, you know, hey, I'm reaching out to you because I saw the things you did at Dresser. And you know, I think that's some of the things that we need. So you never know the impression that you make sometimes, right? You never know how you leave it, but you certainly want to leave it in the best way that you can. Now, I will tell you, not all my departures have been perfect. You know, there have been certainly personality conflicts and just not the right alignment, not the right match from a personality standpoint. You have those, but you learn from them. And then when you make that leap again, you make sure that you got the right things in alignment that you know you're going to thrive.
Yeah. So let's double click on that for a second and look at it and say, if you think back, and without going into all the gory details, you think back on one of those where there was a point of friction, right? And there wasn't good alignment. How have you been able to navigate through that, learn from it, and accelerate out of it?
Yeah, I think probably the biggest example that pops in my head is when I was, so NextTier was a merger that happened between Keen and C&J, and I was hired at Keen as the head of HR. The CEO that hired me didn't tell me that he was going to go to the chairmanship a month after I joined. So they brought in a new CEO who didn't hire me, didn't know me. But we made it work for a while, you know, because we were in the same boat. We were both new and we were trying to change things. And the first year was really good. And then the second year we decided to merge, a downturn in the industry, big pressure to, you know, let's quickly flip everything. Let's, you know, when we merged at Technique FMC, it was what they call lift and shift, right? They lifted things, they shifted it, and they kind of put it together, but left it alone because they didn't want to screw it up. Man, when we merged at Keen and C&J, we were like, okay, 4 months, we're going to merge everything, comp, benefits, you know, structure, leadership. And it was brutal. It was a brutal experience. And when you're not in full alignment with how to approach things with your CEO, you know, we made it work. We got through the merger. We closed the deal. But we both knew that, you know, post-merger, we were not the right team to lead it. And part of it is, you know, I come from a different place. My CEO, I come from Schlumberger. I come from other parts of the industry. Schlumberger, if you look at that culture, they kind of gravitate to each other. If you look at our management teams and you see ex-Schlumberger on it, you typically see multiple people because they like that culture. They understand how to work it, but they also have a different philosophy on HR. I mean, they put a lot of their operational people through that HR mode, and you may see HR leaders that don't have any HR experience. So it's, I mean, it's a different philosophy, and it worked. It works for Schlumberger, but it was not the right connection for me. And I probably, had he been in charge, I may not have been the HR leader, you know, picked for that. Who knows? But, you know, but that really taught me that it really matters. You want the CEO to pick you. You want, because as different people describe to me, I mean, CEO job is a lonely job, and they need somebody that can be their confidant, consigliere, and, you know, that they can ultimately trust. And so you want that relationship to be very solid. And that was a huge takeaway for me out of the NextEar experience.
I like that. That's huge. You want the CEO to pick you, right? And then I'm also thinking back to, you know, reputational management, right? And the other piece, this is fantastic. So when you go through, you think about, all right, your experience at NextEar, and then you were at Talent IQ, then you made the jump from Talent IQ to Cayman. How did you make that transition from Talent IQ to Cayman?
Yeah.
Was that because of relationships? Yeah.
Relationship. You know, I left NextEar when we merged. I was one of the execs that left. So I was fortunate to have a parachute, jumped off with a parachute. But I wanted to keep my hands dirty. And a lady I worked with at FMC, Catherine Gillings, had her own firm, Talent IQ, and she invited me to operate under her umbrella. And so I did different consulting things while I was determining what my next move was going to be. And, you know, I did some work for our old friends at the new Dresser Utility Solutions now, I think is what they call themselves.
Yes, Dresser Utility.
So I did some work for Dave Evans, which was great because I knew a lot of the players. I know the business very well. He had some young HR leaders. I did some talent development training, leadership training. Also helped them with the benefits integration, changing their benefits and saving them about $300,000. You know, and I got recruited to help the Red Cross out with COVID, and I got asked to help. You know, HR Houston did a whole public service thing for people that were out of work from the pandemic. So we did some pro bono work, helping people with, you know, resumes and interviewing and et cetera. So in some ways I reinvented myself, I like to say, because it was, I mean, having not ever been a consultant before, it's totally different. You know that. So it was really different. And through that experience, I built some really great relationships with some peers who were going through some similar situations. And it's a group we may talk about, but we call ourselves the Breakfast Club. And we ended up, you know, writing articles together and doing some podcasts. And we still meet every other week. We're all heads of HR, CHROs, and, you know, it's a great to have a group, a sounding board group that you can, hey, have you, how do you handle this? Or what have you done with that? Or, hey, you know, I heard that there's a job opportunity, so-and-so, you know, so it's, but it's also like a mental health support group too. And, you know, that's part of the vernacular now, that, you know, mental health is much more accepted or understood, perhaps, how real it is. And I can tell you, you know, frankly, that group has helped me through some tough times. So, you know, I lost my dad about 2 years ago, and, you know, I've had some, yeah, thank you. But I mean, I just, as an example, that group was helpful because another guy had lost his dad. So, I mean, it's, you get those things. And so that group's been very important to me, especially since about 2020. But you're talking about Cayman, to answer the rest of your question. The CEO was a guy I worked for at Intertek back 20 years ago in that industry. And we had come into a difficult situation. It was all about private equity. They were trying to go public. They had issues with the EPA, had to self-report. So they brought me as a new HR leader, and they brought him in to clean up the organization, get the litigation settled with the EPA. I mean, I saw people go to jail because of what had happened. So, and then I got the unique experience of pleading guilty on behalf of the company in federal district court in New Jersey, of all places. So talk about a unique experience. Never done it and never will, hopefully will repeat it, but I learned a lot from that about how compliance, if you don't have good compliance, it could go really wrong.
Yeah, that's, well, and you think back to the folks that we know, right, in compliance, going back to our Dresser days, I'm thinking about like Martha Bixby, right? And just, I remember, you know, folks throughout my career that were in compliance and drove that as a function. And early on, I was like, really, you got to be kidding me. And then to your point, right, all of a sudden you start getting exposed to what happens when you fall out of compliance. The consequences are disastrous.
It is
not just bankrupt a company, but to your point, go to jail, right? It is, it's bad enough financially, but then if you're talking about having to do jail time, oh my word, I love the folks in compliance. It's like, hey, you are my friend.
Yeah.
Like, this is great. Come on in.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. You speaking about compliance, if you remember Jackie Chirino with her.
Oh, yes.
She and I had a really good relationship because I respected the role that she played and that HR needed to be a good partner with that. And so she invited us to come to this national compliance conference, all the Dresser HR leads. And man, that whole conference, all I heard was what a lousy partner HR was, you know, and how they mess things up. They don't do things right. And I said, Jackie, I said, you and I need to figure out how we can speak at a conference at this conference next year, because we do things right and we have a great partnership and it can work. It can work. So she loved that idea. And so we ended up speaking that next year at the national conference about how HR and compliance can work together and be successful. So that was my first time speaking at a national conference. So that was pretty cool.
That's awesome. That is really cool. To your point, I think one of the things that gets lost on folks is it's so easy to complain and find what's wrong. But a lot of these organizations want to be able to highlight when it goes right. Right. And I want to encourage people as much as anything. If you've got something that's going right, let's champion it. Right. Get out there and tell people what's going on. That's, we're not talking about perfection, because there really is no such thing as perfection, but it is that you can, when I like to use the phrase pockets of brilliance, there's pockets of brilliance in every company, and those need to be celebrated and held up and built on. And so as you think about where you're at PermaPipe right now, like, where are a couple of those pockets of brilliance?
This company has a long history. It's been through different iterations, but it's got a very solid reputation in the market. So the type of product that we produce, we have some unique aspects to it that differentiate us in the market. And so we in some cases are able to ask for a little bit of a premium because of that, the capability of that product. We have a really good strategy in the Middle East. I mean, it's a booming area, Mike. I can't tell you how much construction I saw around Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Dammam in the Saudi Arabia, Riyadh, tons of stuff going on, lots of building, lots of infrastructure, so lots of pipe. So, for example, the tallest building in the world in Dubai, the Khalifa building, it has permapipe pipe in its construction for DHC. Yeah. So there's been projects at the White House that we've supplied pipe for. So it's a lot of people don't know that, but we've done some really cool stuff, and we have a product that differentiates itself. The Middle East is really taking off. Riyadh wants to be the next Dubai, and
it's a noble goal.
Noble goal. Good luck. But the Aramco is just continuing to try to move and groove. But if you read the journal the other day, that they were talking about the wealth fund there in Saudi Arabia and how much money they're spending on airports and buildings and housing, and they want to be a green energy giant. I mean, they're really trying hard to diversify. In Middle East countries, it's interesting dynamics because you have a lot of third country nationals that do the work. So, we're very multinational, multicultural in the Middle East, more than people would think, because we're pulling in Filipinos and Pakistanis and Indians and Africans, all come in to work in these countries because the money they make, they cannot do it in their own home countries. But the challenging part is a lot of these people, they have families where they left their families, right? So a lot of people, their family lives in India or in Bangladesh or in Manila, and they're here working, and they might get a month off or 2 months off to go back home, but that's it. So they leave their families because that it's the way they can support them. So, you kind of see that in the fracking industry where, North Dakota, for example, you're pulling people from all over the country to do the fracking work. And they're 14 days on and 7 days off. That's a tough lifestyle, but man, they make good money. I mean, they definitely make a premium, and they have a high school degree typically. So, but they do that to support their family. So, It's interesting. We talked about those commonalities and connections earlier that, we're not unique in the U.S. to the things that happen. A lot of countries have similar challenges.
It's wild when you think about it like that. And also going back to what you were talking about on the mental health piece of things, because a lot of times when you're in the office or you're in the field, when you're working, right, you're just thinking, okay, everybody here is working, and you don't realize the baggage that they bring with them. And when I say baggage, right, some of it's good and some of it's bad, just like in anything, right? And if they're thinking about their family back home and they've been away for 10 months, and it's going to affect their performance at work.
Yeah, I can relate to is when I moved to Houston in the mid-90s, I was here 6 months before my family came from Georgia, and that was brutal. I had two young kids, 2 and 3, I think they were their ages, and my wife's by herself. Another unique aspect that I kind of want to highlight, I'm glad you talk about, I don't want to call it baggage, but the loads that people carry, we don't know sometimes. And so I have two kids with autism, forms of autism, and that's really had an impact on me and our family. And, we moved to Houston because we knew we couldn't stay in Georgia. We knew we needed to be in a larger city with better schools. But also I kind of knew I needed to be in a better place to advance my career. So it's moving to Texas, moving to Houston was a huge opportunity for us, and it's really paid off. My kids have thrived considering their challenges. Career wise, I could never imagine the things I've been able to do in my career here, living in Houston. But my kids have made me a better person, Mike. I truly believe that. And, you know, my son, with, if you know people with that have Asperger's, I mean, you got to live by a schedule. You got to plan ahead. You got to communicate ahead of time or you're going to rock their world. And if you think about the business applications of that, you know, Catherine Gillens used to tell me my superpower was I could see around corners. And part of that superpower comes from, you know, my son, because of, you know, having to help him navigate the world. And we talk about the commonalities too. A lot of times, I can tell you, I was reluctant in the past to tell people that I had two kids with autism because I didn't want it to be a burden. I didn't want them to feel sad or, you know, feel bad for me. But I learned that in a lot of ways it helped because people had, they didn't necessarily have kids with autism, but they had other things, you know? And so you find those commonalities, but fortunately or unfortunately, I also found a lot of people that had kids with autism. So it's much more known about and prevalent in our culture than it was 30 years ago. I mean, when my two kids were born, they were unique. I had three different universities come and want to study our blood because it was unusual to see two kids with autism in a family. But it's, unfortunately, it's common now, or it's somewhat common. So it's that's been an interesting journey in itself, and learning what we could do to help my kids thrive, you know. And so that's had a significant impact on myself and some ways my career.
Thank you for sharing that. It's interesting in that, you know, I'm a big faith guy. And from that perspective, I was listening to someone talk, and they'd grown up with dyslexia and is it dysmorphia, I think, or something like that, where it's the shapes, right, kind of get bottled up as well. And ADHD, extreme ADHD. And he said, you know, I went through most of my younger life being told all of these things that was wrong with me. And he said, I fundamentally believe that we're perfectly and wonderfully made, and that, you know, we're made with a purpose in mind. And that the thing of it is there's no normal. We each are gifted. And he said, so instead of looking at my ADHD and my dyslexia as a problem, if I look at it as an opportunity, he said, I can process things faster than the normal person. I can look at problems and see things in a different angle, in a different way than anybody else can. And so that means I can find solutions that other people can't find. And he said, is it what the average person going through school and the way they see it? No, it's not. But that doesn't make me disadvantaged. It creates an advantage for me. I've just got to learn how to use that advantage in a way.
Yeah, I love the way that you've put that, Mike, because, for example, my son there's a spectrum in autism, and mild and more severe, and my kids kind of are bookends in a way, and my son is mild, and you meet him, you wouldn't know it initially, but you pick up social cues, and his processing speed is not that great, but he drives, he has a job. And we figured out, one of the things that we figured out, that he had this unique kind of skill with animals. And so we were able to tailor his education in high school around FFA. And so he first raised a goat, and then chickens and rabbits. And then we decided, okay, well, so we bought 3 acres outside of Tomball, and we bred cows for a while. And so I went back to my roots. My grandfather had a 30-acre farm, cows and horses and chickens. And, you know, so we've raised cows and chickens. We had goats for a while. And he would go to shows. We would the State Fair of Texas, the Houston Livestock Show. Talk about some unique, talk about interesting cultures and unique people go do circles in the cattle industry, in the breeding sector, But he won grand champion at a couple of things, and you know, we were able to figure out an outlet, an avenue for him, and which led to a job at a dog resort, which led to a job with a vet, you know, where he works now. And you know, we weren't sure when he was five what he was going to be able to do. So it's interesting, you know, if you follow, if you allow people to exhibit and you support them and where they're gravitating to, it's amazing what can happen.
Yeah, I love that. There's a proverb along those lines that says, train up a child in the way they should go, and when they grow old, they will not depart from it. And a lot of times, historically, people have misconstrued that, which is pound that round square into a round peg into a square hole and tell them how they're supposed to behave, right? And what that actually means, what it comes from is, the original language was more about like shaping an arrow in the direction of the wood that it was going, so that the arrow could fly straight and further and more accurately than it could if you tried to go against the grain and make all the arrows perfect. It was like, no, follow the wood of the grain, and that arrow will actually go further and more accurately than it ever could have gone. And so it's like training up your children and taking us and our unique gifts and applying them in the way that they were created for us to go, we'll go so much further and do so much more.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You know, he's never gonna, you know, solve physics problems or anything like that, but at least he's found a passion that he likes. He's accepted at his job. He's been their most stable employee in the last 5 years. So, I mean, it's the routine, right? He's at work by 6:30, works to noon. He comes home, he works out, he takes care of the animals, and, you know, then he watches TV. So, I mean, he's in that cycle, but it's good for him. And he has a reason. You know, my daughter's a little more complicated, but we have found things. There's a great program. There's a great place called Brookwood, and they have really some great programs for adults with disabilities. And at some point, they have a campus where people live, and probably 10 years from now, whatever, she'll be there. But you know, it's challenging. Once your kids with disabilities get out of high school, it's difficult. There's not as much support and opportunity for them. So it's really on the parents to figure out, okay, what are the avenues to drive, and how can they have some viability in their life? So, it's not easy. And listen, first, big kudos and shout out to my wife, because she has done tremendous work navigating the school system and fighting for rights of our kids. And she created those opportunities that, you know, my daughter was in a normal classroom all through elementary school. She had a full-time aide, but man, she thrived. I mean, it was a great experience. She had friends, and so it worked really well. Now, got to junior high, it didn't work as well. So we had to make changes, and it was painful, but we figured out what to do, and we got her into a good program for her high school years. So, but man, any parent that has kids with disabilities, it's a difficult path. But I was thankful enough that we could allow my wife to focus on that. You know, she stopped working after we got to Houston, and she's my hero, because she's done a great job of navigating life for these kids. And it's, you know, for us, it's not over. It'll be part of who we are until we leave this earth. So that's the biggest challenge for people like us, is figuring out what's going to happen to your kids after you're gone.
Wow. So when it's amazing, if you think about your career and the way that you've been able to progress and been able to balance that with as a dad of kids with disabilities, how often, right, have you found that tug right? And how have you managed that tug between those two?
Ah, that's a good question. Yeah, it's been challenging. I know, again, I'll shout out to my wife, right? Because I mean, I've had jobs to be able to progress in the jobs that I've done. I have to travel, you know, I have to go places, and, you know, it's not easy to shoulder that burden. So, you know, we were fortunate. My in-laws moved here after Katrina. So they became a big support network for us. You know, my family lives in Alabama, but they've been very supportive. When we needed them, they've come, you know. And, you know, part of it is, you know, Mike, you talk about relationships. Part of it is, you know, making sure that you remember why you're together, you know, and don't let it consume you. And for a long time, it was all you were mainly focused on was the kids, right? And especially as they were growing older. And then, you know, probably about the time I got the dresser, we figured out, okay, we got to start making sure we carve out a little time, you know, for us. And whether it's just doing a date or getting away or for a weekend, or so we've tried to do a better job of that, because we know that our relationship needs to remain healthy for us to be able to give everything that we need to give, you know, for our kids. So, and we've seen a lot, unfortunately, a lot of marriages fall apart, you know, because of the strain of having kids with disabilities. So, you know, it's, but again, you got to invest in it, right? Or you got to be empathetic to what's going on. And she can have just as hard a day or worse than I can have at work. And, you know, again, you, in the beginning, you don't always learn that lesson, but, you know, now I'm a lot more attuned to that than I used to be. So, yeah, it's not easy, but man, again, I have a stellar queen of the universe wife, and, she rocks.
I like that, right? It's the power of a spouse. I was listening to a podcast with, Tim Ferriss and Brene Brown. It's an old one now, right? And they were talking about that. She was saying that she and her husband have a system where they're like, they know that there's never a day where they're both going to be at 100%. And that there's some days where they're both going to be underwater, so to speak. And so they'll just come in and they've got a, how was your day or whatever? And they've got a scale where they're like, on a scale of 1 to 100. And they're like, if they can't co-equal, you know, combined equal 100, they know, all right, they've got playbooks that they've figured out. Like, and if they both come in and they're like 20, they're like, oh, we're getting pizza. Not even a discussion.
Yeah.
It's just, right? It's, yeah. Hey, hard day. Okay, pizza, let's go.
Yeah, so my wife will text me. She goes, what are you bringing home for dinner tonight? So I know that, okay, all right, this is, I got to, all right, well, what am I bringing? What, you know, where do you want? And you know, the other thing we've done too is like, for example, we both like musical theater. And so we bought season tickets to Tuts, which is the theater here in Broadway. And so we, you know, we carve out a Sunday matinee every month or so. And that's our date kind of thing, but it's on the calendar. It's going to happen. You know, and we plan around it to make it happen, because we enjoy that time together and something we enjoy doing together. So you got to figure those things out. So
yes, it's so important, right? And I like what you also said, because I think some of the best advice we were given as young parents is that you're a family and your kids are a welcome addition to it. Is the way it was phrased. It kind of rocked my world hearing that, in the sense that because I was like, no, we're married. And they're like, yeah, but your kids are going to come, and then they're going to launch in some form or fashion, right? And then there's still going to be the two of you. And the healthiest and the best gift that you can give them is a healthy marriage. And And it's so often, yeah, we see people that just, they start worshiping their kids, right? And their kids become the center of their marriage. And then all of a sudden things fall apart later. And it's like, well, what happened? Well, it's because the marriage became second, third, or fourth place. And it's like, but the best gift you can give your kids is to keep that marriage first place.
Yeah, it's not easy because the kid, I mean, literally, my daughter can't be left alone. I mean, somebody has to watch my daughter all the time. So, you know, typically on weekends, it's my shift kind of thing. You know, it's yes. for her to do whatever she wants to do, and we'll do things together too. But there's also, now granted, it gives me time to watch sports, but at the same time, I got to make sure that she gets fed and all that good stuff and doesn't get into mischief. And, but anyway.
Amazed at how you've done that. And I just want to just huge shout out to you and your wife, because that is a noble calling that I know it's one you didn't choose, but it is one that you've responded to. And I just want to say thank you.
Well, I appreciate that, but tell my wife that, not me.
Okay.
I really gotta give credit to her a lot. So I mean I'm she is super parent, and I'm there to carry her train.
Okay. So two quick questions before we wrap up. One, and I hadn't expected this in the way we were going, but if you were talking to parents of kids with disabilities, right, that are career oriented, one advice you said was support each other, right, and bring empathy. But the other one is, is there any other piece of advice you would give them to be successful in their career and successful at home?
I think one of the things is be authentic and be allow yourself. I mean, you have to pick the times to be vulnerable, so to speak, but at the same time, it can show your humanity, right? And I think in business, a lot of times, although I'd say it's a lot different now, but used to be you didn't show emotion, you didn't show feeling. You were, yes, I'll work 90-hour weeks, and yes, I will answer emails on the weekend, and and so I think we're the generational change. We could spend a whole hour talking about that, and I think now the business atmosphere, it's a lot more open. And I think for the Gen Zers and the millennials, if you can show them your vulnerabilities or your authenticity, it can help a lot break some of those barriers down. And I think as a parent I'm very open about it now. I tell people pretty quickly about it, because, hey, that's who I am. Hey, if you know me, that's part of the package, right? And sometimes, I got to, like every Monday, I drop my daughter off at Woodlands Methodist for her program. I don't get in until 8:45 that day. So, I do that because that gives my wife a whole day off. When I do that, then that gives her a whole day. And, so those are the little things that, and I'm a guy, I like to get in here at 7:30. So, I get the shakes sometimes if I'm not here, but, before 8:45, but that's part of my old school work ethic. Right. So.
Hey, identify.
Yeah. Yeah.
That.
I know you yes. can. I know you can.
It's you do. Right. But that I totally am with you on the being torn right between the two. It's this, hey, no, it's my commitment to my family, but I'm supposed to be at work, right? And
I usually I'll leave until six-ish, right, from the office. Man, if I leave before my boss does, I get, and he doesn't care. I mean, he's very supportive, but I feel weird. I don't feel right because granted I get in here before he does, but it's just one of those old school ethos work ethic things that
absolutely. Okay, one other piece of advice that you would give to yourself 20 years ago, if you could go back to you 20 years ago, right, in current day or whatever, and just say, knowing what you know now, what would you advise?
I think probably one of the things I would say is probably be, if you could be, and again, when you're younger in your career, you can't always be as picky, but knowing who you're going to work for better can help you make a better decision. Like, for example, when I was looking at taking this job at Permapipe, I had some great interviews. I said, but hey, I want to go to dinner with you. I want to get to know you better. I want to understand who you are as a person. And he thought that was great, you know, that I want to invest that kind of time before I decide to make that kind of decision. And I think companies, a lot of times, they struggle to give people an authentic view of what it's really going to be like. I just hired a couple people on my team, and I spent an hour and a half with them, you know, in the interview. But I first said, okay, here's my background. This is my career. Okay, and then now here's me as a person. Kids, and, you know, I'm musical. I sang in choirs. Hey, if I, you know, I'm going to break out in songs sometimes. You know, I love Auburn football, and so I'm a passionate college football fan. You know, my dad was a big personality, and he really had an impact on me. And so, I have stuff prepared that I go through with people. But, hey, I want you to know, if you're going to come work for me, this is who I am. So I think you could solve a lot of problems, because you hire people sometimes, you don't worry about the fit, right? Whether it's culturally or with that leader, because I look for people that are compliment me, not are the same as me. You know,
right.
That's a great leadership lesson, is to be comfortable hiring people that aren't your clone. And, you know, I married somebody that is completely different than me, Mike, and it's been great. And same thing, my best teams, Dresser, FMC, you know, now are people that are smarter than me or they're different than me.
Yes, I love it. All right, so I've gotten some incredible takeaways from this, right? Just to run through them real quick, your relationships and your reputation is a bank account. Make sure it's full and you're making deposits more than withdrawals. Don't overdraw it. You want the CEO to pick you, or you want your boss to pick you, and find the pockets of brilliance in the company where you're at and build on those. Make sure you've got the power of a spouse and a support network. And specifically, if parents of disabilities, be authentic and have empathy. And then know who you're going to work for better, and be comfortable with complementarianism more so than being identical.
That's great. Perfect.
That's fantastic. And then the other thing at some point we'll need to talk about is the Breakfast Club. I'd love to hear more about that next time.
Love to.
So, hey, Chuck, thank you so much. Quick question for you. If people want to get in touch with you, is LinkedIn the best way?
Yeah, that's probably the easiest way. I check it regularly. You know, I answer messages. So if you reach out to me, I'll respond on LinkedIn.
Okay. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Chuck. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
You too, man.